The Realist Report. And now your host, John Friend.
All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. The website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other radio programs I've participated in over the years. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to the Barnes Review, the bi-monthly history magazine affiliated with the newspaper. I encourage all listeners to subscribe to these fine print publications if you are not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all of the details. All right, with that said, let me introduce our special guest this morning. Carolyn Yeager is back once again. Carolyn recently co-authored an important new book called The Artist Within the Warlord, An Adolf Hitler You've Never Known, which is available from the Barnes Review for $25. Carolyn, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine, John. Thanks.
Good, yes. How are things? Are you staying busy? It's been a while since we've last chatted.
Yeah, and I have been very busy, and I am also doing very well. I've never been better, John. Things are going great for me. So,
good. Yes. Yeah. Well, that's good to hear. I've been super busy as always. I recently got engaged about a month and a half ago, and we took a trip back to visit my family in Nebraska and just been busy in general. So it's been good. I've been also doing some interviews with political, like right-leaning political candidates that have, you know, run for office in this recent election season, including John Fitzgerald, who's out here in California up in the San Francisco Bay Area. And he's running for Congress, and I can't remember the district. I think it's District 11 or something like that, if I'm not mistaken. And I just interviewed him last week, and I was really, really impressed with him. So I think it's, you know, some of these guys running for office and telling the truth about 9/11, for example, and getting into revisionism and exposing, you know, the Jewish stranglehold over our government and media and banking establishment and just society in general. I think all of these things are very positive developments. So I just
wanted to listen to all of your podcasts with those political candidates and found them very interesting. And I appreciate that you're finding those people and introducing them to us, because we don't know about them. I wouldn't know about different congressional candidates in California, particularly someone like John Fitzgerald, who's not getting much publicity.
He seems like a very honest, straightforward guy, and he got a fair amount of support in the primary. I think it was 25% of the vote he received, which I thought was very good considering, you know, he's gotten, as you mentioned, no media coverage essentially. He was being denounced by, of course, all the Jews and all the mainstream, you know, GOP leaders and candidates and whatnot. So that's pretty typical. That was about the only coverage that I think he really got. So it was good to actually hear him out. I'm surprised I had never heard of him before, because he's been running sort of as like a 9/11 truth candidate and like exposing, you know, Israeli false flag terrorism and kind of, you know, a lot of those issues that I kind of got started on when I began this journey, you know, doing podcasting and writing online and stuff like that. I mean, if we're ever going to really get anywhere, we got to have guys out there doing stuff like this and saying these things publicly and confronting everybody with this information, you know what I mean? And using a platform like that to do that in a very professional way, I think is very important, a very positive, step in the right direction.
Yeah. Yeah, it is surprising that they are coming out the way they are. I mean, they're just coming right out with all this stuff, and that is kind of surprising. And so that gets the public and the media or whatever kind of more used to it, where they can't go into this shock thing. Oh, who's good what he's saying? You know, because people think, well, it's okay. You know, he can say that. The more it's being said, the better it is.
I agree.
will say.
Yes. Yes, I agree. And you know what? We'll talk a little bit more about some, you know, current events and recent political developments here in a few minutes. I wanted to kind of get started and talk about your book.
Sure.
Yeah, I know you recently published an article over on CarolynJaeger.net, that the Barnes Review, now they're basically exclusively selling it going forward. Is that right?
Yeah, for a while, but only for a while.
Okay. Well, you know what? Why don't we just start out? Why don't you give us just some background on the book? You know, what was the origins of the book? How did you come to publish it?
Well, you know, I've talked about that a lot, the origins of the book, and I'm kind of going to start downplaying that. And, I just would rather just talk about the book, itself. It came about because there was a collaboration between Wilhelm Chrisman and myself, because he introduced me to the memoir of Harmon Giesler. And this book is actually translations from Harmon Giesler's memoir. I would say it comprises, we took, well, Wilhelm took, but the between one third and one quarter of Giesler's book, where Giesler was describing and memorializing, I guess, his interactions with Adolf Hitler during the war years, and goes into a lot of details, very fascinating. And so Wilhelm introduced me to that, and he was translating it for me, and we decided it was so good. He started out with the section of going to Paris, a Giesler's trip to Paris with Adolf Hitler, along with Speer and Brecker, the other architect and the sculptor. So this was so fascinating. I never knew that they had made that type of a trip. I knew he'd been to Paris. But so we said, well, we need to publish this somewhere. So we started publishing it in the Barnes Review. And now we always, they promised they'd make it into a book, but then it didn't happen. So time went on, Willie passed away, and I finally decided I wanted to get this into book form. So it did happen now, and I've got it sitting here, I've got it in my hands now, this last edition, and it's a beautiful book. It's such a beautiful book, and I wanted it to be a beautiful book. It's everything I would hope for, and it's very, very interesting, and the reason that people should want to read it is because it tells the truth. It tells the truth because Giesler was a truth teller. He was a friend of Adolf Hitler, and he was a good, sincere National Socialist and a fine architect, and he spent a lot of time with Hitler. Hitler enjoyed Giesler's company. He was very comfortable, you can tell, with Hermann Giesler, and he invited him to spend time with him a lot. And as during the war, when he was at these headquarters out in the eastern provinces, he, like Bormann and others, would invite Giesler to come because they knew that Hitler was needing some artistic inspiration and some time, and he enjoyed working on building plans with Giesler. They did a lot of planning together for the projects that Hitler had in mind for the cities and for the renovation of the cities. And so all that time, Hitler's talking. Now, I'm going to just say one more thing and then I'll break. Hitler enjoyed or seemed to have a reason for wanting to discuss things of the past, you know, what he did, his decisions, what he did and why he did them. So while most of these meetings took place in 1940 and through up till 1945, Hitler also spoke about earlier times to Giesler, which Giesler apparently wrote down and took notes on and so on. And so part of it goes back to 1938, 1939 in some of the information that's given. But there are a lot of people have told me that there are things in this book that they did not know, and it's all new to them. And they're really happy to find it out and to learn about it. So that's why it's an Adolf Hitler you never know. Of course, that's for the general public who wouldn't know him, because most of our inner people, you know, they do know the truth about Adolf Hitler, but for the public at large, this is truly a Hitler they have never even dreamed of. So,
yes, it's a very personalized view of Hitler, and certainly, well, most of the chapters focus on like key decisions he made throughout the war, right? I mean, mm-hmm. that's, and it kind of gives his justifications and his explanation for everything. And that's one thing, I mean, the more you dig into revisionist literature, the more you get to understand the German perspective, the German version of events and, you know, their narrative. If you're honest and objective, I think you'd have to agree with them and, you know, realize that they were really the righteous and the justified, side in this war, right? I mean, that's really my big takeaway. And Hitler, yeah. And Hitler is not this monster at all. He's this very respectable, courageous, honorable man, a very creative artist, which it seems like, you know, based on much of the information in your book, that was really his passion, what he wanted to do. He wanted to build and create and really make the world a beautiful place, right? And yeah.
He said that, he said more than once that if he had not gone into politics, which was caused because of the Versailles Treaty and the way the World War I ended and how it turned out for Germany, he would have become a famous architect. He was sure he would have been a famous architect because he was that type of man. When he set himself out to do something, he did it very, very well and in a big way. So, he understood architecture, and that became his passion over painting. Although, you know, during World War I, he continued to paint. And as we point out here in the introduction, there are about over 700, around 750 or so paintings and drawings and sketches by Hitler in existence. There's probably more that aren't in existence that we don't know about. So that's a lot, you know. It wasn't like he just painted a few little watercolors when in a certain period of his life. He continued. He was serious about it. But then, he always thought that he would eventually, he started painting to support himself, you know, before the World War I. He was supporting himself that way, but he was still planning on becoming an architect, and he was studying architecture on his own. He was quite the person who was devoted to study, and he was so smart and had such good retention that he didn't seem to ever forget anything that he read. And so he was always studying problems. He studied political problems and later and figured everything out. So he's an amazing personality. And this book might give a little intimation of that, but it doesn't really focus on that. Because it's what Giesler said. But of course, Giesler was amazingly impressed with Adolf Hitler and always very loyal because he knew him and he was so impressed. The thing I'd like to say about what Giesler said a number of times was that when he was in Hitler's presence, it was so overpowering. You know, his personality was so magnetic and all encompassing and overpowering, and that he just was carried away with whatever. I shouldn't say it this way. It's kind of hard. That's how people get this wrong impression. But that Hitler was so persuasive because of that you just agreed with him. You know, you could not agree with him because you had no argument against him.
Yes.
And he thought that was an impression that he made on many people, and that's why the Germans were so ready to support him. All the higher up National Socialists said that they thought he was a genius, you know?
You know, and one thing that really struck me reading Mein Kampf and listening to speeches that Hitler made and stuff like that was just how articulate and concise. He could explain very complex things. You know, he really had the world figured out and could articulate it and explain it to people in a way that made sense and was very powerful and very convincing, right? That's really kind of the main thing that struck me, where, you know, we look at our politicians, our quote unquote leaders, and all they do literally is lie to us and deceive us and play games with us. And then you read, you know, Mein Kampf or listen to some of Hitler's speeches, and he's clearly explaining what's going on, who's responsible. You know, and it wasn't always, oh, it's the Jews. I mean, of course, he certainly did talk about the Jews and the role that they played, but he talked about many, many other important factors in what was going on. And it just explained, it really had the world figured out. I mean, I think that's what it boils down to, is he really knew what was going on and recognized, you know, the very evil agenda being directed against his nation, and, you know, wanted to do something about it and felt like, correctly, that he was the leader to do it for his people, and that's exactly what he dedicated his life towards doing.
Yes, exactly right. Exactly right. He had a real sense of his destiny. And I think people who are marked for high, you know, for high ability to lead people and to see, you know, deeply into the situation, feel that, you know. I mean, they feel that it wasn't ego. It wasn't any of the things, of course, that the popular press wants to describe him as, but he was really very, mild mannered and clear spoken, and he didn't throw tantrums, and he did get angry. I'm sure at times he got angry. And he expresses his anger, but he wasn't nutty about it in any way. So. And then let me just say that the book is organized kind of chronologically and according to what Giesler wrote, going from starting with the trip after the French campaign in 1940, and then goes a little bit back to explaining how that French camp, how the, well, the first, the his treaty with the Soviet Union right before the invasion of Poland, and the story about Poland, and then how he planned the 1940 Western Offensive. And one thing that is revealed in here, which is not said very often because they don't want to say it, and I don't think it's historically documented at all, is that because these others have tried to give a different picture, is that that brilliant French campaign that gave Germany control of Norway, Denmark, Netherlands, Belgium, France, and I may have left something out there. In 1940, that was the blitzkrieg that took place. So in like 3 weeks' time, 3 or 4 weeks' time, all that territory was won over. And the other countries thought they had sufficient defenses and so on. But Adolf Hitler, because his first plan, his first idea, his first order to start this invasion was stopped several times because of treachery on the German side, that they had revealed the plan to the enemy. And that's a whole area that this book really reveals a lot, is the treachery in the Hitler administration, you might say. The Hitler regime, it was deeper than he ever realized and deeper than he wanted to believe. And so that's a whole other story that I could talk about. But
yeah,
he had time then, because he had to put it off, to work on his own plan. And he worked out this plan with the gliders going and taking the fort there, that was supposed to be the big defense against anything going into Belgium. And he worked all that out to the finest detail, almost before he let anybody else know about it. And then he slowly let a few more people know about it, because he didn't want it to get out. And he didn't let his generals know about it at all until the very end, when he described how the plan was going to work. And they were amazed. And, but then later that plan has been attributed both to, von Manstein and also that, traitor, I call him a traitor. I can't think of his name right off the bat. You know, the guy he fired. Let me see.
I'm drawing a blank myself.
Yeah, I've got it here. Franz Halder, who was chief of staff, who later had so many bad things to say about Hitler, but never said them at the time that he was chief of staff. But he took credit for it. And he's the one who gave Hitler this old Schlieffen plan from World War I, and Hitler knew right away that that wasn't going to work. So he had some other thing, but then he worked out this brilliant, totally innovative campaign, and it was totally successful. And so they don't want to give him credit for it, but he is. And then when they say that he messed up the war, you know, meddling and didn't know what he was doing, that's absolutely not true. He was smarter than and more original. And the generals, he knew he always had to have surprise. You had to come up with something that they didn't expect, and you had to go about it in a different way. Where the generals were tending to go through the same, you know, supposedly approved military way of doing things that they were used to. So
right.
It was really hard for them to give him the credit he deserved.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. And you had mentioned the subversion of his administration, you know, there's these traitors involved and trying to undermine him, trying to sabotage his efforts. Sounds familiar, right? With what's going on with Trump. But, it was going on with Hitler as well. And, you know, most people would assume, I guess, you know, based on all the nonsense Jewish propaganda spewed about Hitler, that he was this very authoritarian person and everybody fell in line and, you know, Nazi Germany, and there was no dissent or anything like that. But as your book demonstrates, you know, there was a lot of subversion in his administration, you know, a lot of traitors actively undermining what he was trying to do. Could you maybe address that, you know, briefly?
Sure. And thank you, John. You said that really well. And yes, he trusted people more than you would think. You know, he wasn't, and he believed that you had to trust people. He didn't believe you could order people around. This comes from Table Talk, but by the way, that, you know, you couldn't, he didn't think you could order people and you wouldn't get the best from them. They'd just do what you forced them to do. He wanted to get the best from people. So he wanted to persuade, he thought it was his responsibility to persuade others that his ideas were right. And he spent a lot of time doing that. And he did that with the military. You know, there's controversy about, well, he had that old Reichswehr, and then they turned it into the Wehrmacht, and these same old thinking type of people. He should have got rid of them all. That was a decision that he made. He made the decision to keep them because they were, you know, the tradition of Germany. He was very big on German history. Hitler, he very respectful and, you know, loved Germany and all the great Germans that had lived, and he read all that, was aware of all that. He knew he was carrying on a revolution. At the same time, he wanted to keep Germany intact and united with all Germans. He didn't want to have a class warfare of any kind in Germany. That was what he was fighting against. So therefore, there was all these military people who were very capable and very good, and for the most part they were ready to go along with Hitler. But as little time went on, and once Britain declared war and was forcing Germany to act in certain areas, first Poland, a lot of them got upset about Poland, and they didn't like, they thought that was bad for Germany's reputation in the world and so on. And as Hitler always said, they never appreciated the Bolshevik threat. So Hitler was appreciating the Bolshevik threat, and it really was, turned out, Stalin did have a plan to invade Germany and all of Europe, you know, right before Hitler's Barbarossa. So Hitler was in tight spots, and he made the decisions he thought were the best ones for defending and protecting Germany. And a lot of these military men didn't like it, and they were slowly grumbling amongst themselves. And this were some of these military guys in the West who gave away the plan for the first plans for the invasion of France, and actually Belgium through France. And so, and Hitler didn't know who it was, but he knew that they were giving away. So he was aware of treason right in the beginning. But he thought, well, there's always people like that, and there's always ways for the enemy to get information through their spies and so on. And so that's one reason why you have to have surprise. You can't do, you have to change, you have to make sure that what you're doing they don't have. And so he put that on himself to do that. So that's why they delayed that invasion a couple of times or three times or something. And finally, and then Hitler said in the end it was better. It worked out better because the weather was bad during those times. And he had time to get his own plan made. So I'm repeating myself now, but this is important. And so then he did, and it was so successful that the military was thrown back on their heels, you know, and they couldn't, those who were already against Hitler and trying to plot something, because there were early assassination attempts that didn't work. And so they said, no, okay, we're supporting Hitler. Well, then with the invasion of Russia, that's when they went along with it, but most of them were loyal, but some of the highest ones were the ones who weren't. They disagreed. They thought they knew better. They had this idea in their head that Hitler was just a nobody. He didn't have any experience. How could he be telling them what to do, you know, and making these plans? And then he had made himself commander-in-chief of the armed forces.
Yes.
He could directly, you know, direct things the way he believed they needed to be done. And if they had done everything he asked, I don't think that the war would have taken the turn it did, because Germany would have had a victory in Russia before the United States came into the war. So, but they didn't. There were some of them, they were, and as it went on, they were blocking the success of the German troops, and they were passing on the information to Switzerland, and from Switzerland it went to Moscow. And they knew what the Germans were planning. And Hitler wasn't aware that it had gone so far. He wasn't aware of all that.
Wow.
He was aware that when they got to started their new attack, that the Russians were already there and knew what was going on. They even went into, they even captured Russian headquarters, and they found there their own attack plans. German attack plans that were in the hands of the Russians for that very place. And so he knew, and they were working on that, but he wasn't prepared to make a kind of a wipeout like Stalin did when he was suspicious of things. You know, Stalin just, you know, executed everybody, arrested everybody, put them on trial and executed him and so on, or just kept him in the gulag, whatever. But Hitler wasn't prepared to do that to his military. So you have to, what it comes down to for me now, after being so familiar with the contents of this book by Giesler, is that should he have done that? What would it have been better? But it went against everything he was fighting for. He was fighting for a united Germany, not for a broken up revolutionary, you know, that type of revolutionary Germany, where people, you know, suspected one another and didn't trust one another. So it's kind of a tragedy. If the truth could be told about all this, it's one of the greatest tragedies of all time, what happened here.
Now, what kind of explains it? Because a lot of the research that I've done, and you know, again, if you read Hitler and understand what the party was all about, they did want to unite the various segments of German society and kind of promote a meritocracy rather than sort of the class divisions that kind of dominated Europe. Oh, and from what I understand, that's really kind of
class divisions were very, very strong in Germany. They were terrible. And to the point where the aristocratic Germans didn't even consider the working class Germans to be, to have any value at all, you know. And that was what Hitler was working to change. So go ahead.
Right. No, I agree. That's confirms a lot of what I've read and understand about the situation. And, again, from what I understand, a lot of these higher level military guys, they came from this sort of upper class aristocracy, mm-hmm. you know, the upper echelons of German society. And there was always this, like, hostility towards Hitler, who was like this working class guy saying a lot of, I guess, to them, revolutionary things in the sense that, you know, they could potentially be losing their, you know, their high status, position in society, or not necessarily lose it, but it was being challenged. You know what I mean?
Well, I don't think, John, that they felt that way. That wasn't the first thing that they felt. They didn't feel like they were going to lose anything because Hitler made it clear that he wasn't going to upset the industrial class or the aristocratic class or the, you know, the landowning class. He was just making the common German an important part of everything rather than a nobody who they were used to thinking about, and give him his rights and his due and make things better for them. And so I don't think they were afraid of that, but they didn't like, his war aims. They were the military, and some of them, the top ones, didn't want to attack anybody. They didn't want to go after anybody. They thought that they wanted to be part of the Western world that was against Hitler. They wanted to make up with these people. They wanted to make up with Britain and France and blah, 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 on their terms, you know, because it was okay with them. They weren't being too hurt. Well, a lot of them, they did know that Germany was under terrible stress, and they did support Germany, but up to a point. And then at that point, they were saying, and you know, a lot of it really was the treatment of the Jews. And a lot of these military leaders were from, what's the part of Germany that was over to the east?
Prussia?
Yeah, they were Prussian.
Yeah.
And the strongest military organization was among the Prussians, and they were good, you know. Hitler had great respect for the Prussian military. So, they were Prussians, and they were used to, being, around Jews. There were a lot of Jews there, and, they didn't like a lot of them were also very sincere Christians. Some of the worst traitors were super duper Christians, and their whole thing was what he was doing was bad. You know, it was bad behavior. We're not going to behave this way. And they tried to protect the Jews. They didn't like his attitude toward the Jews.
Interesting. So, okay. Yeah. That makes sense. Very fascinating. Well, the whole book is definitely worth reading and worth owning. I purchased a copy directly from the Barnes Review a few months ago. And, it was, and maybe you could kind of talk about this as we wrap up this conversation. It was both from you could buy it from the Barnes Review. You could also buy it on Amazon. Going forward, is the best place going to be just to go right to the Barnes Review?
Well, since you asked me, John, the fact is that the Barnes Review has a certain amount of copies left. And when they're sold, they're not going to carry the book anymore. Well, they'd carry the book, but they're not going to publish the book. They're not going to publish the book anymore. And not going to take the time to go into here, but they're not going to publish the book. So now I'm considering what way I will get a different publisher or self-publish. And I'm looking at that. But the book that we finally ended up with TBR is a beautiful book. And it's just the book just the way I wanted it to be. It's a high quality, all the way through. and it's a heavier stock of cover paper and interior paper than you usually find. So you're getting a great deal for $25. I don't know if I will be able to have this high quality when I self-publish, because of some of these places I'm looking into, they don't offer it, you know, they don't offer it. So, I'm thinking about CreateSpace, because with CreateSpace, you're automatically on Amazon, and, you know, I have to be able to sell it. So, and I, of course, it's not even that I need to sell it to make money. I want to get into circulation, because I think it's very, very important. That's the whole point of it to begin with. You know, it was to get people to understand this side of Hitler and get people to read this. That's where it stands right now. But, yes, they have, TBR will have copies for a while. And if you want to get one, I'd say you should order one now, because you'll never get a better looking copy than what they're selling in this second edition for $25.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I got my copy right here, and it is a outstanding book, very professionally done. The cover is incredible, and I'll have the cover on, you know, as the main image of this blog post. You can kind of take a look at it. It's really a cool book. A lot of great information. You know, one of these books that you really need to own and really read and understand if you want to get an accurate understanding of what World War II is all about. And that's kind of how I wanted to conclude. Could you maybe, and this is a topic we always inevitably talk about anytime we do a podcast, because both you and I care so much about revisionism and the truth about World War II and about Hitler and the National Socialist movement in general. So could you maybe, you know, kind of wrap up by addressing this? Why is this information relevant today? I mean, it's 2018. This happened, you know, decades ago. Why should we even care about Hitler and National Socialist Germany and what really happened during World War II? Why is it relevant and important?
Well, I can only really speak for myself. I know there's reasons I could give for, you know, in general, for history and so on, the sake of history. It's relevant because the problems that we're having now go right back to that, which you and I agree on. They go right back to that. That's where it all started, with 1945, with the total demonization and wiping out as much as they could Hitler and National Socialist Third Reich, and then the invention of the Holocaust and all of that. So you have now in this book, you know, it doesn't talk about Jews. I think in a couple places you see the word Jew, and then maybe in some of the commentary that Willie Chrisman and I wrote, you'll see something about Jews. But it's not really big on writing about Hitler and Jews, and doesn't even mention the Holocaust at all, because it was never talked about. He never talked about it, because there was no Holocaust going on. They had these camps, and everybody knew that, and he didn't talk to Giesler about it, or Giesler didn't write about it. So that's not there. So there's nothing in this book to keep it from being sold, like on Amazon, who's gotten to be so picky about things. But there's no reason. They're not banning books about Adolf Hitler. So, the reason it's important to me is that it hurts me like hell when I read this stuff, when I see the current view that's constantly espoused, why I keep writing refutations of it over and over again. I wonder to myself, why do I do it? You know, it's the same old stuff. Why don't I just ignore it? And sometimes it's better to ignore things. But I just can't stand when I read that stuff. It's just so sickening. It's so sickening. It's so wrong. It's so unfair. You know, I do what I can to change it. And, I'm feeling very hopeful lately that it is changing. It is starting to change. It is starting. People are starting to get tired of Holocaust, and that will lead them to, the whole World War II issue and the free speech issue. And I think that Donald Trump has helped us a lot with that. I really do think that you have to look at it that way, that he is helping us a lot with breaking through this political correctness and freeing people up to talk and think about things. And it's going to continue. I do believe he's determined to do that. So I see a real link between Adolf Hitler, who I admire so much, and Donald Trump, which is, I think is going to, in the end, is going to turn out well.
Boy, I sure hope you're right. And let me just say a couple things. Number one, the narrative of World War II, the fake Holocaust, you know, this hysterical demonization of Hitler and any form of white identity, right? That's what this is all about. It's about attacking the very concept of white people having a strong, healthy racial identity, undermining that idea, making that idea, that concept illegitimate and tied into violence and oppression and supremacy and all these other, all this other nonsense, this fake story about what happened during World War II. It really is the bedrock of what everything that's happening today. And this is on display on a daily basis. Think about what's going on with immigration. I'm looking at my Twitter feed right now. I retweeted this video of Tucker Carlson interviewing this Jewish liberal activist. And they're talking about the immigration debate, and this Jew's up there saying, well, look, we need to open our borders because there's asylum seekers all over the world, and it's just like World War II. You know, and my people had to flee Europe and, you know, resettle in America. So the whole narrative is tied into World War II, and it's a fake narrative, and it needs to be confronted and explained that way, because that's what it is. It's weaponized to attack our identity, to attack our nation, and to undermine everything this country has stood for. And, you know, that's exactly what's going on. So, I don't know. I guess what I'm trying to emphasize is that those that care about the white struggle, the pro-white movement, however you want to describe it, you can't avoid revisionism. You can't avoid confronting, you know, the truth about Hitler and the Nazis and the fake Holocaust head on. You know, you're not going to get anywhere until you do. And I firmly believe that we have to address this stuff head on, because it is what's being used to advance all these liberal, leftist, communist, anti-white ideas and agendas.
John, you know, they know that. So that's why they don't want to let up at all on the Hitler Holocaust story. They don't want to let up on that because they know that that's going to unleash all the rest of this, that they won't have that to hold white people down with. So, they're going to fight like crazy. They're going to fight like, as I pointed out in one post, cornered animals, you know, because the more they get cornered, the worse they're going to be. And that's what I see now. You know, this hysteria that's going on the left, and now the Democrat Party is that they're afraid that they're losing. They're afraid that they're starting to lose and they can't stand it. They're scared to death. And they start calling everybody Nazis. I think this unhinged stuff that's going on, calling people Nazis and, bringing up the Holocaust and so on in relation to, border crossers, illegal border crossers, is gonna backfire. I think it's going to be good for us. I think it's good for the freeing of speech.
Yeah.
What do you?
I agree. I mean, and I certainly agree with your point about Trump opening up space for our ideas and really directly attacking this politically correct tyranny that we live under and just openly flaunting these things. You know, he had the most recent controversy is that Corey Lewandowski when he was on CNN, and he's just mocking the guy, you know, about the Mexican child with Down syndrome or whatever he said, and you know, he's womp womp and, you know, making fun of him and just, you know, totally defying this politically correct atmosphere. And I think that's very important. In fact, I mean, going back all the way to when I first even heard about Trump, you know, being involved in politics, he's at the Republican debate in front of, you know, millions of people, you know, on television certainly, but, you know, there's tons of people in the audience. And he just openly denounces political correctness in front of millions of people. And I thought that was so powerful. And as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh wow, this guy has a lot of potential to really change things. So in that sense, I agree with you. And, you know, as much as, you know, it's, Trump is such a roller coaster because, you know, sometimes I love the guy. He's great. I love the things he's saying. And then other times I'm very disappointed. And there's been a number of examples of this. But overall, I do agree with your assessment. I kind of question, though, and I kind of want to challenge you a little bit on how much things have really changed concretely. I do think that the political discourse has opened up and our ideas are getting out there and people are being exposed to this stuff in a much bigger way. And I think a lot of that is thanks to Trump. But really, what has changed? And let me just give you a few examples. I recently wrote an article for American Free Press. It was just published in this most recent edition of the newspaper. So it's out there. It's not on the website. I do hope that they put it on the website. I don't know if they will, but it's in the print edition. And it deals with these five Antifa guys that were basically proven to have violently assaulted and attacked a Trump supporter. There was a police officer that witnessed it. There was two firefighters of the Berkeley, the Berkeley Fire Department that witnessed this and in court provided testimony and explained what was going on, explained the situation. And these people were let off the hook. And, you know, there's Antifa people in the courtroom, you know, Antifa supporters in the courtroom, you know, trying to influence the jury, which it seems like they did based on some of the reports that I was reading of it. And, you know, so these people are being let off the hook. And we saw this all throughout the campaign. We still see it today. Political violence and political terrorism being carried out against Trump supporters, against, you know, right-wing people. You know, look at what happened with Charlottesville. These people are just openly committing terrorism and political violence against their political opponents, and they're being let off the hook. You know, they're not being punished. Meanwhile, a ton of people involved in the whole Charlottesville rally last year are being sued by Jews, who are basically conspiring to eliminate these people's First Amendment rights. I mean, that's all they were doing. They had a legitimate rally organized that was permitted by the city. They did everything in their power to, you know, do this legitimately, and look what happened. So we see these sorts of things going on. You know, we see people being fired from their jobs for saying politically incorrect things left and right, which, you know, I think could work in our favor, you know, ultimately, because people are going to recognize how ridiculous the whole situation is. But really the biggest thing is what has changed with our foreign policy and what has changed with our immigration situation? Trump says a lot of good things, and maybe he is doing some things that are helping us on the immigration front. But ultimately, we're still being invaded by millions of people every year. You know, we're still basically doing the bidding of the Jews in the Middle East and, you know, really just doing anything the Israelis say. I mean, you know, Trump is a bigger or as big of a Zionist stooge as any other president, in my opinion. So could you maybe address those concerns that I've raised?
Sure. Now, first I'll say that the good that Trump has done for the country so far, and this opening up of speech and this attack on political correctness and the revealing to everyone the fake news media, you know, and he goes after that hard, and that's not easy. It's not easy to do what he does. That's why nobody's done it before. He's the first person with the guts and the backbone and the intelligence and the confidence, the self-confidence and so on, and the freedom from being told what to do by other people that that has ever come along, and that's has ever been president, and that's maybe since Andrew Jackson or something, but I don't know if you compare two people so far separate in history, but that has done that. We need to remember that. And the good he has done outweighs any bad that he has done. There may be things that haven't improved yet, but it doesn't mean they've gotten worse. Nothing has gotten worse than it was before, which under Hillary, we know what'd be going on now. I mean, I didn't understand how important this election was. Of course, I wasn't going to pay any attention to it. I was going to ignore the whole thing. I can't stand this. I don't want to hear these people. And but then when Trump entered the race, and I just happened to hear it on a news report that he had he was declaring himself a candidate, and he had said that the Mexicans were sending their rapists across the border. So we needed to control and secure our southern border. He said, "Oh wow!" I mean, that at that moment, that was so big. Nobody was saying that. That was like impossible for anybody to say. Oh, nobody can say that. Well, he said it. And I thought, man, how great. There's somebody running I can support. I'm going to support him. I had never watched him. I knew who he was and everything, but I had never watched him on TV. I never watched The Apprentice. I don't have TV and I never saw one single show of that. So I didn't realize he was this, TV star, really, but I knew he was, famous for all these other reasons. And so I said, wow, I got somebody to support, and I thought this would be more interesting. Well, it turned out better than I could have ever expected, and he kept going, as you know. So now though, people are saying, well, he's a Zionist stooge and so on. No, he's not a Zionist stooge. He, from the beginning, said he was an Israel supporter, and he's, from the beginning, has nothing against Jews. From the beginning, his daughter was already married to this Jew and was a fundamentalist Orthodox Jew. And, so all this stuff, the world he lived in New York and so on, full of Jews, he was leading the parade, the Israel parade or something once for in New York. That was a big deal. He was so proud of it. He was in the front, with his baton or something. And all of this is true, but still he has consistently downplayed any of this nonsense that comes from the Jews. He supports Israel, and in his campaign he gave a speech at AIPAC and he said, I'm gonna bring the capital to Jerusalem. I'm gonna bring our US embassy to Jerusalem, and he said all that stuff. But then commentators said, well, every president said these things, but they didn't do them. So we just said, okay, hey, he won't do it. Well, he did do it because he's carrying out everything he said he was going to do. Now he's tried with the wall. They've really put up, snowballed him there, and they've been successful. So he's getting around it. He's getting around it. He's got a lot of things that he thinks are important for the country that not beyond the wall, that's, the tax cuts were important to him so that we would become wealthier. We have become wealthier already as a country. He's got a lot of support. He's got a lot of Republican support that he didn't have before. He needed all this. I think he's very smart. I think he's done very well. And I think that people who, because they have a history of, being anti-Jewish and anti-Israel, and a lot of them are more anti-Israel than anything else. I'm not. I'm anti-Israel, but I'm not more anti-Israel than I am anti-Jewish in the USA. That's for sure. Because Israel's not the number one thing, and the fate of the Palestinians is just not the number one thing for me, like it is for a lot of activists. I'm seeing what Trump is doing and what he intends to do. And he is not, in my opinion, I've written this a number of times, that he's not anybody's puppet. He's not anybody's, stooge. He's his own man. Okay. So, what we can get from him is so important and so far-reaching, like these Supreme Court nominees, for God's sake, so far-reaching that it outweighs his collaboration with Netanyahu and his liking for Israel and his support of Israel. It outweighs that, in my mind, and you're not going to have heaven on earth. You're not going to have perfection, and at least not right away. And what we need to do is to support this man 100% and keep him in office for 8 years, and then help with the working of finding somebody like him, whoever that would be, I don't know, at this point, but to run again, or we're going to lose it all. Just like Obama.
All.
I think, yeah, I overall, I tend to agree with you. I think he's certainly the best thing we've got going, and we need to continue to try to make the most of the situation. And at the end of the day, I mean, I do, and I've always said this, Trump has always struck me as actually like a genuine, honest person. You know, that's why he's stood out so, in such stark contrast to all the other candidates. It's not only his rhetoric and what he was saying, but he comes across as a very genuine person. You know, he means what he says, and you're right, he has always supported Israel and, you know, always basically kissed their butt like all the other politicians. But it's also true that he did stand up in front of the American Jewish Congress or whatever it was and say, you know, you guys don't like me because I won't take your money. You know, he said that. Basically, it's what he said. So he's a very different type of political operator. And I do agree with you that he is his own man. He is certainly far more independent, you know, than any other political figure that I've ever seen in my lifetime anyways. And, you know, the way he just operates, not only here in the United States, but his presence on the international scene is very welcoming. I mean, he's a very different type of political actor, and, you know, he's saying a lot of very good things. I like the way he deals with people. He's very blunt and honest and straightforward, and he's good. You know, I think it's good what's going on. But that being said, there are still a lot of very real problems we're dealing with here in the United States and around the world with this crackdown on free speech and these, you know, radical leftists basically running amok, engaging in political violence at will and, you know, getting away with it and stuff like that. This is insane. And of course, these immigrants coming over here and exploiting our country and everything else. It's, there's a lot going on. And, I think you're right in the sense that we need to rally behind Trump and really use this opportunity in the best way that we can.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I don't think you should use the expression, he's kissing the Jews' butt. He's not kissing butt. He's not kissing butt of Israel. He is simply, he's truly in agreement. He truly believes that Israel is our strongest ally in the Middle East. He truly believes that. So, you know, that's what, you know, what are you going to do? That isn't a deal killer for me, because there's too much that he's doing for us and that we need done. And, you know, speaking of these people going crazy, these leftists going crazy these days, that's because of Trump. It was Trump coming on and putting showing that he's a different kind of a president that has caused these people to go nuts. And I think it's funny. They are upsetting, but it's getting to be funny to me because they're so far out. Oh, they're so far out that they're not going to get any support. But I'll just say this. I think that, they're thinking they're not totally nuts because this is their reasoning. If they get all the, the party run by brown and black people and so on, which is what these brown and black people are aiming at. They're aiming to take over the Democratic Party. And then they, let as many people in. That's why they're so upset about immigration. They gotta be, you know, pulling these people in who will vote for their party. And if they have these numbers of foreigners and brown and black and even Asians vote for them, everybody who's not white seems to think they should vote for these Democrats. But they might get turned off if they get too far out. But then they can win. Even if they're crazy and no white people vote for them anymore, they can win if they can change the population enough. And Trump is doing everything he can to stop this, continuing to change our population to non-white. And he's doing everything he can for that. And you know, he's not a dictator. He can't tell everybody what to do. He has to go through the channels and, he's getting more and more support. And we need to support everybody who supports him. And we need to vote for Republicans, no matter if we like him or not, because Republicans will tend to vote with the party, and then Trump's in control of the party now. He's in charge of the party, really. It's a great deal for us. I don't know how it could be any better, because you have to be realistic. Where would anything better come from? You know, these Dems have been in control all this time and these leftists have been in control. But I think, if we go along with it and quit being jerks, you know, we can start with Trump turning that around, turning that back. And it's all you can do is to start turning it. You can't just make it happen all at once.
Yep. I agree. And it's, just to kind of echo some of the points that you were making, it is becoming very, very clear what is going on in this country, and the left, the Democrats, the radical left are truly exposing themselves for the just open borders, you know, anti-American fanatics that they truly are, and for the violent criminals and political terrorists that they are, you know, these Antifa people, you know, and assaulting people with, you know, at will across the country. So, I mean, I think the political lines are being drawn very firmly, to anybody that's paying attention anyways. And, you know, I think that's, again, a positive development.
Yeah, I agree. You know, they have to show themselves. This has to be going on. It's right. It's doing us a favor. You know, to say, oh, it's terrible what's going on. Yes, it's terrible, but people are seeing that. All the white people are seeing that, and white people don't like that. I don't care. Well, there's some. You see those white people out there. Oh, God, they're so brainwashed. But a lot of non-white people don't like it either. So I don't mean to just make a color demarcation line. Still, majority white interest. If we lose our majority, which we're quickly doing, we have to get it back somehow by deporting people and not letting any more come in, deporting the ones who are here. So we have to do that. And Trump is the only one who seems to have the guts and the power and the willingness to do that. And
yes. That's
against him. And he's a white man. He doesn't want the United States to change like that. He can see he's very smart, and he's been at this for a long time, you know, and he's had these same views for a long time, long time. It's amazing too that at 72 years old, he's so healthy and in spite of being overweight and so has so much energy and still so bright. And, that's why, you know, I draw parallels between my view of Adolf Hitler and my view of Donald Trump, and people can disagree. I don't want to make a big deal out of it because they're already saying Trump is Hitler, and that's not supposed to be a good thing. But
I know what you mean. Trump is he's very impressive. He's very sharp, and you're right. He has been making a lot of these same points for years. I was actually just recently watching a YouTube video of an old Trump interview from like it had to have been the mid-80s maybe. I don't even know. It was definitely, you know, a good 20, 30 years ago. And again, he's basically making a lot of these same America First, anti, you know, immigration type positions. It was very interesting. And he's always talked about, you know, wanting to make America wealthy again and you know, really protect our economy and put our economy first. And again, he was making those points back then. So, again, I agree. I think overall Trump is definitely helping us out big time in a lot of ways, but it's still going to be a long struggle as is being proven. I mean, the whole entire establishment is working against him to undermine everything that he's doing.
Yeah, so but they're exposed. Look at this, you know, this Russia thing, was supposed to be so bad. Oh, look what they're doing. This is so bad. It turns out to be good. It turns out that they're exposing all this stuff that they're doing, which is really even illegal if we can ever get it to be, you know, tried that way. These people are treasonous, and at least breaking the law of the country. And so, you know, it's all being exposed. He said he's going to drain the swamp. Well, how are you going to drain the swamp unless you expose the swamp? And so he's been complaining about this Russia probe, but I think he sees now that it's having amazing results, just the opposite of what they wanted.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a good point. Well, Carolyn, I think we are going to go ahead and wrap up. This was a great conversation. You know, I always enjoy talking about Hitler and revisionism with you, and your book is outstanding. And I do hope everybody listening goes out and purchases a copy and gets this book out there. It's It's a book worth reading, worth owning, worth studying. It's got a lot of very important information, and I think you give a very objective account of Hitler that is, you know, certainly lacking in our mainstream educational establishment anyways.
Yeah, and I'll just say, John, that I still have a few copies of my own that I've offered to sell people if they send me, if they pay for it by check, cash, or money order, by mailing my P.O. box. And I've got that on my website, so they can see it there. But, you know, I will inscribe the book to them personally. So if anybody listening wants to take advantage of that, there's still a few left, so they can write to me pretty quickly, and I'll put them down for that.
Okay, very good. Now, your website, of course, is carolynyeager.net. Is it best for people just to contact you directly through your website if they are interested in purchasing a book?
They can do that, yes, or they can email me at carolynyeager@carolynyeager.net. So that's easy, too, either way.
Okay, perfect.
Hey, thanks, John.
Yes.
Myself, I have enjoyed it very, very much.
Yes, me too. Thank you very much. We'll have to do this again soon. And you take care for now.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.